This is January 27th in the year 2001, and this is Bob Gilgore interviewing Elizabeth Carter at her sister's home at 321B McDade Street.
Good afternoon, Elizabeth.
Good afternoon.
Please hold me down. I'd like to begin the interview with just a broad question, and that is, what was it like growing up in Carrboro?
Well, for us, we lived on Broad Street and lived at the corner of Broad Street and Fowler Street, and I think currently there's a Habitat in that spot now, and it was rental property. I don't remember the person that rented the property to my mom and my dad, but I guess for us, you know, my mom and my dad were both in the home. There were seven of us. I'm the middle child. They're three older, three younger than I am. It was a little unique because my older sister had, we all had a responsibility to each other. And my older sister basically had the responsibility of all of us looking out for us because she was the older, but we all had the responsibility of kind of watching out for the one that was under us. It was like this hierarchy process is what I refer to it as now that I'm older. And you looked out after each other that there was no babysitter. My dad was in the home because of his polio that he had had from early on. My mom shares with us, I always remember him being in the house and caning chairs on the front porch, and my mom getting up in the morning making biscuits, and she would be in the kitchen when we'd wake up and she'd be singing hymns. She never participated in the church choir, and there were times she didn't get the opportunity to go to church because of doing things around the house or doing things for my father because of his health, or doing things for us. But she always made a point of making sure that we went to church. It was very important. I participated in everything in church, from Sunday school. I was an usher. I went to conventions representing First Baptist Church. We just did everything, and our mom made it sure that we participated. The church, I guess, offered the social aspects of our lives because it was so important that on Saturday you need to start getting ready for church on Sunday. Like, you had to get your bath, and then we had a tin tub because we had running water, and we've always lived in homes that had running water. There was not having to go outside to get water, except the one house we had, and that was on Broad Street. You had to go out the back door to get to the bathroom, and that was the coldest piece of that house. And I never remember truly being cold because we always made sure that we were covered up at night. We had plenty of what we consider covers, and that meant blankets and things to keep us warm. And I remember the house being warm and loving, and it was, my dad was always there reading to us, telling stories. There were always people because he did have polio and walking crutches. Usually people would come in, see him and talk to him, and I guess he was an advisor, and children enjoyed coming and playing in the yard because my dad was usually on the porch working, doing the chair caning, and he also would make oak cane or splints or whatever they call it to cane the chairs, the oak thing. My dad used to do those type things, and he would be sitting there talking with somebody all the time. I always remember my dad, memories of him being on the front porch on Broad Street doing something and talking with somebody about something. And we were in the yard playing in the dirt. There was no grass in the yard. It was dirt. We played in the yard, you know. The Bashees, Miss Cora and Mr. Prevett, lived next door, and they had a lot of children also. So there was always somebody to play with, and Miss Cora was my mama's best friend. Across the street was the first chief of police for Carrboro, being black, and that was Mr. Jeff Bashee, lived across the street from us. And it was just a loving community. Everybody knew each other, and you know, kind of like my dad was there, and I guess he was like the patrol or whatever you called, and if there was something going on with other people at work, that they knew that Mr. Bud was there and would do whatever he needed to do for them. I always felt, I never remember being hungry, as some people say that and assume that as blacks we were hungry and didn't have clean clothes, didn't have this, didn't have that. I don't remember any of those things. Truly don't remember being what people consider to be poor. I think we just kind of made the best, and my mom and dad, if there were hard times meeting bills, hard times doing something, that was discussed separate from the children. I don't think as people do today, they have those conversations in front of the children. I think we were very protective. We just kind of were good children. I think we couldn't go to the center, is what we call Hargraves. We were supposed to come, walk the north side, come home, play in the yard, not go to the center, come straight home from school, don't stop, don't do anything. We were expected to be in the yard at a certain time, and at night we had to be in the house at a certain time. So even being poor or not have as privileged as some, we had a lot, because I think what we had a lot of love. My dad was the person that, he was, even with his disabilities, he pretty much ran the house. And whatever he would tell us if we were doing something, I'm gonna tell your mama. And we knew that was trouble if he told mama, because mama was, she was heavy-handed with the switch. She believed in, you know, if you did something, you had to get a whooping. And she was like, sometimes it was like, as Mariana shared, is that, and she said, and we all laughed now, and said, mama, you know, you'd have been in jail. You'd been just coming out for child abuse, but you knew it was all in love, and you didn't care a lot of grudges. She spanked you, whipped you. I call it whipping. I don't call it spanking, because I think there is a great difference in spanking and whipping.
What is
oh, spanking is like you give the kid a couple of licks and a paddle's on the backside, and usually with your hand, and you move on. With mom, it was like a switch, and she would get an elm switch, which had little ridges on it, and she liked to get them dried out to make sure that she was really getting you good. So, and she thought that she was doing all out of love, and I'm sure she was doing out of love, but didn't feel like a lot of love at the time. I have always been afraid of getting a whipping. I even now don't like you to yell at me too much. And my mom was like a yeller, because I think she, you know, looking back at what mama had to do to make sure that we had our basic needs met, she had to do a lot because of my father's disability. Because I don't know what my dad brought in as far as monies for cane and chairs, but I'm sure it was not very much. My mom paid all the bills. She did a lot of negotiating, and I say to her now is that she doesn't think that she sometimes is that smart, but she basically, with some consultation and conversation with my father, ran a household with seven children. She'd go out and get what she needed. She's always had excellent credit. You know, I say to her now, even at 79, that she has credit cards with limits of $100,000, and it's like a minimum income. So, you know, she's always maintained excellent credit, where, you know, you could go down. She would always pay her bills off at the store when she bought groceries and stuff on time. And my dad was the one that had the head for the math and could keep up with those type of things. So it was, I saw it to be more of a joint effort. And thinking back, growing up, I thought nothing about it. I had a mom and a dad in a house. And most of my friends on Broad Street, they had a mom and dad in the house. You know, they, I knew.
So you didn't see many broken families?
You know, I did, and my mama says that I one day came home from school and asked about where somebody's daddy, and she tried to explain to me the best that she could that they didn't have there was not a daddy in the home, but that they had a daddy somewhere, that everyone has a daddy.
Did you grow up feeling that absentee fatherism was common or uncommon?
Well, we didn't give it, I didn't give it a lot of thought. Everybody had a daddy. On our street, in our particular neighborhood, everybody, there was a father within the house. He may not have been there all the in the house all the time and doing the same things that my dad, but I guess the thing of it, I didn't see growing up that there was a lot of this class separation. It was like people just living together and making the best of whatever they had. And I think now what you find is that people are truly working harder than I think, or as hard as people did when my parents were trying to provide for their families, but perhaps not achieving as much because they don't spend as much time with their children as I think they should. But that's one person, and hopefully not passing judgment on someone else, but I just see the children. I guess I see that way because we were always important to our parents. My mom was, her mom died when she was young, and so her father sharecropped. So my mom was basically passed from one family member to the other family member. And my dad's mother died young, but his father was around with them, and in fact, I think lived with my mom and my dad some when they got married. But the thing of it is, we kind of have this joke, is that my mom prayed for 7 children. You have to realize that. She has always wanted 7 children because she didn't want her children to have to grow up like she had to grow up if something happened from place to place and place. And she said that when she was young, she would go to her relatives, and she always felt like an outsider, and that there were a lot of laughing and talking, but she never felt a real part of it, and she didn't want us to have to go through that. My thing I say to her, could you not have prayed for something else from God other than 7 children? 7 children means a mass amount of responsibility. But she seemed, you know, I don't think she has any regret. We perhaps are not all what she would want us to be, but I don't think anyone is perfect, and I'm not sure what she's wanting.
You had mentioned that your parents rented. Did they want to own a home?
They were buying a home, and my dad, in fact, some of the properties that were there near the Frank Porter Graham site was properties that my dad had owned, and I remember them talking a lot about. And that was one of the reasons that Mama was working so hard, was to help to build a home. And when the school came there, that the Frank Porter Graham site got all of that site, a lot of that properties that were owned there by people of color. And I think that's part of it, is that, you know, I don't think families realize that they had say-sos and where the properties were. And I'm not sure whether they had a say-so. It was kind of like, you know, there's a black person on this land, we'll just kind of like do what we need to do, acquire the land, build a school, or acquire the land to do whatever we needed to do with the property. But indeed, that strip, I think it separates the highway now or something, because there was something about the school and the highway, and that's vague memory because I was younger. It truly wasn't into the politics of things as I am now.
Parents, or did black people in general have trouble getting a mortgage?
That I don't know. I don't think so, because the community that I currently live in is the old Lincoln Park area, and perhaps one of the more concentrated African-American where people, I think, individuals were purchasing homes. The home I live in is now about 50, I think it was built in the 60s, 70s or something. It's 30 plus years old, and it still is predominantly black. And as I had a friend say to me, there are no longer what you consider black neighborhoods, because they are neighborhoods where people tend to stay if it is what they like to do. There is a lot of stability in my neighborhood, a lot of the original owners. So I think a lot of people own property, and a lot of people rented property, but I don't think it was a big thing. You either own the house or you rent the house. And
you also talked about your father was always talking to someone on the front porch when he was caning. And I wonder if he had the same penchant to talk to the children. And if he did, what were the sorts of things you remember him stressing, talking about?
Well, I think one of my work ethics, I think I got them from my mom and from my dad, because my mom always worked hard, and she always went to work. My dad worked within the home by caning tears and repairing tears. And my dad got up every day and did what he needed to do. I do remember my dad saying to us when we were little, and I guess it was in sharing in his attempt to tell us about the cruel, mean world, is that what you have to realize is that the white man will do you like they do a mule. They hire you today, and when you die, they hire another one. And I'll never forget that, is that they have no feeling and compassion toward you. You're just someone that performs a task for them.
Did you feel that you grew up with prejudice toward whites, or did your parents try to teach you love thy neighbor no matter if he's black or white?
Well, I think my mom and dad, they taught us a lot of love, and I don't think it was in relation to race. It was just, I think that they were just good people, and they believed in treating people right. I guess the first time we had moved from Boyd Street up to Main Street, where the Art Center currently is in Carrboro, and we were staying there with some, I guess it's removed relatives of ours, that her mom had some health problems, and my mom had agreed that she would take her family, and we would move into the home with them to help take care of Miss Annie, so she would not have to go into a nursing home. And plus, my dad was home all day, and you know, he did not have he couldn't get around very well himself, but he walked on crutches he never got a wheelchair. And I remember him, he had a straight back chair, and we would kind of like pull, because we had wood floors, we would, or linoleum, and we would pull him in a chair, or he would scoot himself, make the chair scoot across the floor, and because he was a determined man, and to do whatever. And I guess it's just thinking now with my brother being terminally ill, I guess that's where he gets some of his will and determination, because my dad maintained a lot of, he was mentally alert, I think, throughout his whole life. I was away at college when my father passed in 69, was my freshman year in college. But they sheltered us from a lot of prejudice and things that, you know, it was like in most small towns where we had the tracks that separated in Carrboro, blacks and white, and we truly had the tracks, because I think the only family, black family, that I truly remember being in what I consider a white neighborhood was Mr. Bynum, Mr. Phil Bynum, that lived across the railroad track, across from what we call the Farmer Exchange. And he had white neighbors around him. We had to go down Fowler Street, up the hill, to get over to Mr. Bynum's house. And I had a friend there, Marsha, that I used to go see. But, you know, we played in the yard, and he had a nice big white house and a nice yard that we used to play in. And I think whenever you went, even you ventured that close to a white neighborhood, pretty much is that unspoken rule, you need to stay in the yard. And then that was kind of like the rule with us, you need to be where your mom could come. My mom had a big mouth, she could yell forever. But where your mom could look out, see you, call you, that those type of things. But my first encounter with what I consider to be racism was going to Carrboro to the grocery store, and I'm not sure it was Hearns or Andrews, that grocery store, to pick up some things for my mom with some of my other sisters and brothers. And I think it was my younger ones in the middle. I think I may have been the older in the group. And the drugstore in Carrboro, we had gone down, gotten the groceries, was on our way back. We had often stopped in there to get a lemonade, because they made homemade lemonade. And we had the groceries. And this time I put the groceries on the floor, and I kind of ordered the lemonade, hopped up on the bar stool because it was not taken. And the lady said to me, you can't sit there. And I looked at her and like got down, and I asked why, and she said, you just can't sit there. We paid for the lemonade and just walked out. And I don't even remember us having conversations about that incident.
It obviously stuck with you though.
Well, you know, the thing about it then is that, you know, I went back to, I think, to the comfort of my home, and it was okay. It was okay. And I don't even think I shared this story with my parents at that time.
Do you ever wish that you could have gone back and relived that and said something?
Oh, I wish that it would happen to me now.
I guess you do wish you could go back and relive that moment.
You know, even too, I remember walking out to Carlboro and going down, I guess it's West Main Street, and at that time the homes were truly lived in by whites in Carlboro, and is there where the Weaver Street Market is, and that's the street I was going down, it's Weaver Street. And some of the white kids were in the yard, and they called me nigger, and it's like, oh. And I guess that's why I say to people that unless you've been discriminated against, you can't start to describe the pain. It is like, it gets at the core. To me, it is like an open wound with salt in it. It just burns, and it burns, and it burns, and it burns. Nothing anyone can say can ease the pain in the heart, and I guess that's why I do what I do today, hoping that things will be better for my grandchildren. I have taught my children to advocate for themselves, and when I first had my children, I used to truly be afraid for my children. Truly be afraid, and I used to say to them, you know, when you go to school, and, you know, that people, and you have problems and things, and you need to question authority and ask people what you need to do. Unfortunately, my daughter didn't feel as comfortable with it, and I think if she could turn things back, that she would change some of it and be a little bit more vocal. But always say that you're important. If they want to know why and how, you know that because your mom tells you that. I make sure that I validate my children each day before they left home, so that the world would not have to do those things for them, and it make their task, the world, that much easier, and hopefully my children would feel anchored, and you know, that they wouldn't have to go look elsewhere for people to say that they were important. I think it's so important for people to feel good about themselves regardless of what, where they come from.
How did you deal with the anger that you must have felt by being discriminated against and hearing these names from them?
Just hardened. You know, I think It perhaps is the reason that I do some of the things that I do now, is because I want to shield the children from a whole lot of cruelty and just unnecessary hurt and harm that can come to them. But hopefully I am breaking barriers. I know I can't. I will not be able to do it all in my lifetime, but hopefully what I do, it will make a difference. So I don't do any of it for anything for me. But I think it's so important that someone has to be out there and advocating for what's right for people in general.
When you tell your, when you told your children that they're important, are you saying that they're not seen as important by others in society in a way?
I think sometimes that, you know, I think blacks and other people of color sometimes look down. And I want my children to know that regardless of how they're viewed by someone else, that you're important if you're by no one else. You're first important to yourself, because I feel you're only as important as you feel that you are. And but secondly, you will always be important to me. You will always be important to me. And that when you're out there and you're facing a cruel, hard world, that you have, you know, a safe haven to go back to, that mom is there and I can hear her saying to me, Rodney, you can do it, Kim, you can do it, or any child that I come into. I hate to see children or even any person of color feeling that they can't do anything, because I think this world is basically a blank check. You can do what you want to do, write as much on the check as you want to write on it. It's just that you have to be willing to go through some things in order to get to get the money's returned on that check.
Are there any other things about your childhood that stand out? I know I got a lot of the history from your sister, and I don't want to, I assume that you had a lot of the same experiences with your growing up, and I don't want to repeat some of the questions. I would like to talk about your experience at Lincoln, but if there's anything else in your childhood that stands out that you want to tell me, I'd like to hear it.
I think that's pretty much it. I think that my mom and my dad did an excellent job at you know, looking back and thinking about the obstacles they had before them and the things they had to do. I remember my mom being, because there were limited monies, that sometimes we got hand-me-downs from people that she had, that she did the domestic work for. But she always brought them home, washed them, cleaned them. I remember my brother John one time saying to her, "Mom, why do we always have to get there? Hand-me-down stuff they don't want." And my mom said, "You know, you take even the trash in order to get to the good things, because people are not going to take out the good things all the time that they give to you. Since they don't want them anymore, they don't want them anymore, and you have to weep through them and throw them away. But you appreciate people, what people give you. And then you come home and you decide what it is that you really need out of all of that."
How many hours a day did your mother work?
I never really thought, because I think Mom was gone half the time. By the time we left in the morning, about the same time we left in the morning, and sometimes Mama got back, it was dark, I remember that. Her daddy was there, and he would have started doing dinner or telling us to do what we need to do, so you won't have to hear your mama when you come in. You know how your mama is if things are not done like they needed to be done.
So she had more than one job?
She had multiple jobs. She would do two,
at the
three.
Same time.
Huh? She would do, the thing about her, even with the limited education, she says now is that what people are paid hourly. My mom was making, when she, way before she got where she could not work, because she, I think she just truly believed that if you worked hard, you should be rewarded for that hard work. Because there are times that, you know, someone will say, "What did it make?" Mama said, "Oh, I was making that when I was working, so you need to be making more than that." And I have a sister-in-law that is, she works as a housekeeper, and when even the grandchildren say that they're not, if they're not living up to their potential, she said, "You can do better than that. People were doing that when I was a girl, when they did not have the opportunity to attend school." So, you know, I think my family has always stressed education, and I think more so because they recognized that it was truly, truly important. As I said, my dad used to read to us. We were well into, can't call it middle school, but into high school, older elementary, before we even got a television. There was a lot of reading, a lot of listening to radio, a lot of sharing of history, where my daddy or my mama would talk about what it was like with them growing up. So it was that continuing telling of the story. So hope that it would be told again. And I guess I'm glad that it was shared, because my dad died in 1969, my freshman year in college, and he had always wanted for one of his children to go to college.
Did your parents, your grandparents, talk to you about education as well?
Well, you know, we are probably different from most people. I don't remember what my grandfather, and that was on my mother's side, grandpa. That's the only one. And as I say to my children, we didn't have a grandma, and which is unusual. My dad was he was older than my dad, my mom. They both had been married. My mom had a bad marriage and was divorced. My father's wife. And I guess that's one of God's order of things, is that had my father's wife lived, we may not even be here having these conversations today, because he talked of how much he cared for his first wife, but she died. And he later met my mom and married her and was pretty much like a father to her. And I think that's the piece where she always, because she would say to me, you know, "I always did what your daddy told me to do. I never questioned what he said." And I said, "But, you know, a marriage is a partnership. It's not a dictatorship. And that you have to work together toward one common goal." So I envy and admire anyone that have an opportunity to have a grandmother. And I guess that's why I've always told my children that, you know, when you go to grandma's, regardless of what she says, you have to do what grandma says, because she's your grandma. We never had a grandma to make cookies for us. We never got to go to grandma's to do those type things. Grandpa used to come see what he called my mom was doll, because my mom was one of three children. She had two brothers that were younger. And my grandfather lived out in the Mount Sinai area. He bought a house out there. He didn't drive, but he would come see Dahl any opportunity. He's left Mount Sinai Road walking, and people had picked him up. He would stay only a hot second. He would see Dahl, and he would go back home. So there was a lot of love, and he worshipped Dahl. I mean, Dahl was his, just as he called her Dahl, his Dahl. So.
When did you go to school, Elizabeth?
I went to school in first grade.
What years?
You want me to think back that long? You know, I didn't have to keep
gone.
It's forever. I don't remember the year, but I first attended Northside. We had to walk. And to walk, we walked from Broad Street, and we cut down through to go up, I think it's Starlight it's called now, but it's, we had to pass the Baldwins. It was Mr. Henry Baldwin. He had a wood yard there, and we cut through the wood yard, go up the hill, and go through Sunset. And there used to be a branch that we had to cross over to get up the hill, because all the beautiful landscaping that we do for schools now, it was not done to Northside. And so you had to go up the hill, and it was this branch. The children had to cross a branch, and I always remember the branch because it had a significant impact on our family, because during a hurricane, my brother, Joe, my oldest brother, was swept away. He fell off the branch and fell down into the water. So it was neighbors and things that actually saved my brother. And it's ruin waters that go across there, and that is the true memory of walking. And we're living with my mom, and
so you entered Northside.
Went to Northside.
6 years at Northside.
Spent intern. Went to Northside. Then I went to Frank Portogram. Went over to Frank Portogram. I think
what
I was there 6-7. I don't know years dates very well. 6-7. I went there. He graduated from the Chapel Commerce School District in 69, I was at first class to integrate into the Chapel Hill High School. I was a little bit disappointed that I never had as much of a chance to attend Lincoln. I attended Lincoln I think it was 8th, 9th grade, I attended Lincoln High School. And it's like you always look forward to attending Lincoln, because there were a lot of things going on at Lincoln, a lot of things that involved the community. It was, I think, the focus and that the stability there in the community, where we got the opportunity to come be ourselves, sharing of things that were common amongst us. It was, as I said to you earlier, it perhaps was like a safe haven for us, you know.
Explain that a little more, what safe haven meant.
You know, it was a time that, regardless of what you did in your particular neighborhood, is that you came together and people were there that loved the school, loved the heritage of the school. You know, parents had an opportunity to be themselves. You didn't have to worry, as we were now, about people picking up kids. You know, we would go to school, and like us, our parents were not able to go to with us to events, but we could go there, and I don't think mom and dad had worried about us because we were there, because there were other adults there, and you knew that if you did something wrong, it got back perhaps before you did. We did not have a telephone in our home perhaps until about the same time we got the television. We'd always go to a neighbor, and it was not unusual for black families to not have a phone. Usually someone else had the phone, and they would tell you, people did not mind you coming in to use the telephone, because it was sharing of things. And it's like, you know, I don't have anyone to come to my house, even though I live in a predominantly black neighborhood, and know all of my relatives now, to borrow a cup of sugar. But it was nothing for Miss Cora to come over and want a cup of sugar or something. But I think the safety piece of Lincoln was is that it was like our world, and we got the opportunity to share and enjoy ourselves. And, you know, I don't ever remember, and maybe they were there, and it's the pieces that I cut out, you know, like white faces in that school.
So it's all your community here?
The entire community. You knew everyone. No, you knew everyone. You know, at lunchtime is that it was when, now they have Parks and Recreation to do some of the intramurals. You play basketball at lunchtime. You know, you go into the cafeteria and you would have, you know, we always going to school. We took a brown bag lunch. We usually took bologna sandwich or some type of luncheon meat, salami or something. And you get whatever it costs, nickel, dime, quarter, whatever it took for the milk money. And that's what we had. And you didn't eat anymore until you got back home and got something to eat.
What were the teachers like?
Well, I thought I had the best teachers in the world.
What made you think?
Yeah, I remember I had Miss Peace, Mrs. Peace, and then Mrs. Smith, and I thought Miss Smith was, I was going to have her forever, because I was in Miss Smith's first grade and all through, and then I got Miss Peace when I was in the older part of the elementary school, pretty much in schools, and it's what call now is tracking, is that you were in high performing, low performing, whatever, and you stayed with that same population of that same group of students. Now, as I say to Dr. Peterson and to some of the school administration, we call it looping now, but in black schools we were looping long before it became proper to do, is that you had basically that same teacher all the time and knew everything about you. And it was like, oh, when do I break this vicious cycle?
So that continued on into Lincoln?
Pretty much into Lincoln, because I basically, the same group of kids I went to class with. When we started to break away from that and me having different individuals within my class, and not just because there were white faces in Chapel Hill High School, but also different black students in my classroom, was when I got to Chapel Hill High School.
Do you remember anything about Lincoln and sports or extracurricular activities?
Well, there were a lot of things going on at Lincoln, is because there were always, after school, you could see the guys practicing football or whatever sports that they were participating in. The band was perhaps the highlight of the school, and everyone, and I wanted to always be in the band. In fact, I got Mr. Goston with the band director when I was at Lincoln High, and I played the cornet for a brief period of time and got to wear one of the black and gold uniforms for a brief period of time. The band room was in what is the gym now. It was in the basement. You used to go down and had all these old instruments, and we had this little room that all the band, he had the responsibility of the band students and having us be seated properly and be quiet. I'm sure acoustics were horrible because they're horrible in upstairs in a gym, but that's where he taught band. And when the weather permitted, you would see the band out on the field with formation and all those things. To me, it was just the thing to do. Was to play in the band, and when there was parade, you could see, you know, Lincoln High was to the Chapel Hill community what Hillside is to the Durham community, and what Hillside continues to be to the African American community at Christmas time, when you see the kids that are following the band in hopes that they will see them perform, and it's a true art. Because you see the drum major, and I remember the drum majors and the white hats, and usually it was a thin guy, but truly very proud and gentleman that was leading the band, the majorettes. What disappoints me now is to watch the two schools and not see as many African Americans participating in these activities, because we've always enjoyed the arts. And I'm not quite sure why we don't do those things now. Is it that we don't feel a welcome part, or we feel like we have no place in that? But the band was the place to be. Football.
Did the band make you feel important?
Oh, yes. It's just like just watching them perform with the just the finesse and the charisma that they had, and just the band director was I think it was Mr. Brasher at that time or someone. I don't really know the names because I was much younger. It's just I always wanted to do it. I don't remember the name, but when I got there, it was Mr. Golson, and I can never forget Mr. Golson because he was Mr. Golson.
Did he lead the band when they went marching out in the street?
Not that Mr. Golson was there. I think the man, the gentleman who was there before had gone over to, was working at Hillside.
Did being in the band make you feel important? It sounds like you were saying to me that looking at the band made you feel important.
Well, it did, but it was not what I thought it to be because it was a lot of hard work. And once you get there, you always want to be where someone else is. That's because you don't know what they, what it requires you to look like they're looking at the time that you're observing them. But it was a lot of hard work. Eventually, I quit because it wasn't what I thought it to be, but I still enjoyed the band. You know, on Friday night is where they had the Lions Park, and it's now I think there is like Fidelity Court Laundromat or something in that area, and that's where I used to go on to football games on Friday night. And we lived on Main Street. And of course, because my older brothers and sisters, they got to go more than we did. We'd sit on the porch and watch people walk to the game and back from the game, and because of the loudness, the band was always at the game, and you could hear the drums and the loud instruments sitting out. And my dad always made an effort to go sit on the porch and watch people as they come back, because it would also mean that he would get to have conversations with some of the people that had attended the events. My mom was not as outgoing, and she's not very outgoing now, but my dad was pretty much, even Ben, with his disabilities, was the more outgoing part of the family. But there was always something to do at Lincoln Park, always something to do at the Lions Park with the bands and the football. And by the time I perhaps was old enough to go to the games is when we integrated schools. And
you didn't go to the football games in 7th and 8th grade?
Well, no, I was not old enough to go. You have to realize about my parents that truly this is...
You were strict, huh?
It was an order to things. And if you were not old enough to do something, you were not old enough to do things. Even my older sister sometimes, when she had to go, she wanted to go places, she had to take one of us with her. And because of the things, and then my mom was, if she wasn't back on time, oh my God, you would have thought she killed someone. My mom would fuss, and it wasn't worth it to me. So I wasn't as anxious to go out, and she used to take my brother John with her in order to go out, and I guess he was the watchman for whatever she was doing, but she would just tell him she wouldn't take him anymore with him. So eventually he would still come back and tell whatever she did, so well, and she would take it the next time, but it meant that she got to go out of the house.
When you went to school, did you have lockers or
cloak rooms? What I remember is the hook, and you could put your coat on the hook in the classroom. It was like on the wall, and you could put your coat there.
Uh-huh.
And it was pretty much, you had the desk. The desks were large, but they were older and a lot of times scarred up and damaged. You put your books under there, and your coat hung there. The lunch sack went in. I remember my lunch sack going under with my thing.
So you on one of the walls in the classroom, you
can hang your coat.
Your coat, and then you had to carry it to the next class.
Well, you left it there because you pretty much.
Oh, that was your homeroom.
That was pretty much it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember the thing of changing classes as much until I went to Chapel Hill High School, because when I was perhaps considered in the high performing group, and we pretty much stayed in the same classroom.
Now
we went across to home ec and maybe some other things, but pretty much you got that.
You're talking about 7th and 8th grade
mm-hmm.
at Lincoln. And
I was at Frank Portogram for 7th.
think it was
8th and 9th.
I think it was 8th and 9th that I spent at. It was 8th and 9th that I spent at. 8th and 9th I spent at Lincoln High. I only spent 2 years at Lincoln High.
And were you
and that, the coat thing was on the outside. There was, yes, there were changing of classrooms at Lincoln High. Now, different from my sister, when I went and Mr. McDougal was there, you had to walk to the right of the hallway. You had to walk to the right of the hallway. You had to move in an orderly fashion. It couldn't be all that noise in the hallway. You need to be going to class.
Pretty strict.
Pretty strict, pretty much. But you didn't think anything about it. And what you're doing early in the morning, when we were the younger classes there, we looked forward to lunchtime where we could go and go into the gym and watch the intramural sports, watch the girls play, watch the boys play. You know, at graduation time was a time to I look forward to, because that's when the seniors got to do special things, and they would have where they would will someone this and will someone that, you know, will, you know, X person this when I leave this school. I will to Elizabeth, yada, yada, yada. So, and a lot of those things that you just look forward to that, because, and you looked up to the seniors in the building and the upperclassmen.
I have heard similar stories, and I'm trying in my mind to categorize some of what I'm hearing. It sounds as though there was a lot of performance at the school.
Mm-hmm.
It was performance oriented.
Mm-hmm.
In many ways, the band, the singing, the acting, the sports, and also it was very competitive. Lunchtime, you didn't just have your bologna sandwich, you went and played ball, or you watched someone else compete in classes. Is that a fair characterization to say that the school was performance-oriented in the arts and sports, and it was competitive?